Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. The digital era has changed a lot, from the way we communicate to the way we gather and disseminate information to the way we market products. And we'll be talking about the marketing side in just a couple of moments. But first, the annual report on the state of the news media compiled by the Pew Research Center came out a few weeks ago. It showed that the digital world has sharp elbows and is having a huge impact on the traditional ways of gathering, disseminating, and accessing information. Joining us by phone is Amy Mitchell, Acting Director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism at the Pew Research Center. She managed the News Media Report. It's Amy, so nice to have you with us.
Nice to be here, Don.
And welcome home. This is a homecoming of sorts.
It is, yeah. I grew up in Glendale, went to high school here, and have now been out in the D.C., Maryland area for the last several years, but always love to come back.
And still have family here, obviously.
Absolutely.
Well, once again, welcome home. Well, let's get on with it, Amy. There's lots to talk about today. And, you know, in looking at your report, obviously it continues the state of significant transition, does it not, in our news media?
Absolutely. You know, one of the things that we've seen in the area of growth is really the movement and the establishment of mobile, not just digital, but digital mobile in terms of the way that people are accessing news, the kinds of content that work and get attention in that realm. So for audiences, there's a lot of opportunity there. The more challenging side is one of economics, is how news organizations can continue to support themselves and find ways to support their operations in this digital era.
Well, you certainly found in the report that newspapers certainly and television at the national and local level are having a little trouble drumming up some of those revenues they so badly need.
They are. I mean, and we've seen, you know, now the evidence in the newsrooms where newspapers in particular, our estimates show, put the industry down 30% since its peak in 2000 and below 40,000 full-time professional employees for the first time since 78, which is when that data began to be collected. You know, and much of that is tied to the revenue losses that then lead to fewer resources to be able to put into newsroom and newsroom staffing.
Well, we've certainly seen that here in St. Louis, as so many communities have. The Post-Dispatch is, in many ways, just a shadow of its former self. The institutional memory is basically gone because all of the veteran reporters are no longer with the paper.
Yeah, you know, on the positive side, one of the big developments in newspapers, and newspapers we talk about a lot because they were really the first and the hardest hit in this transition, particularly because words moved to the digital realm before video and audio, at least in terms of working really well for consumers. But newspapers had gotten to a point really towards the end of 2011 where, you know, they were beyond their skeletal staff. They were, you know, really getting deep into the bone there in terms of trying to stay afloat. And something needed to change. They needed to experiment. They needed to figure out ways of bringing in new revenue. And that really did begin to not only happen at the experimental phase, but actually take root in a number of organizations around the country. You now have over 300 newspapers that are have some kind of digital pay plan, paywall, if you will, but a digital pay subscription. And there are signs that there can be success from this. It's not just something that can work for the New York Times. It's something that can work for smaller organizations, local organizations as well. In many cases, it's not making up for all that was lost in the print dollar because you just can't get that dollar-for-dollar value digitally, but it is really bringing that line up to a closer to an even mark, and for certain organizations, actually some signs of profitability for the year.
Well, the New York Times is really in its second try now with the paywall. The first time around didn't work very well, but it does seem to be working better now.
Yes, they see pretty positive signs of success. But, you know, as I said, it does now, you know, what I kept hearing for the first year after the New York Times launched theirs when I'd go out to talk to news organizations was, you know, well, what about us? You know, we're not the New York Times. Our audience isn't like the New York Times. We don't have the global reach or can demand the kind of pay structure that the Times does. But as more and more of these began to be adopted, there are signs that it can work at the local level. More and more news organizations are trying, you know, or just deciding that they're going to take that plunge and see what happens. And at the same time that this is, that they're going down this route, it opens up that question, too, of, well, if I'm going to be asking people to pay for this content, you know, perhaps we need to revisit and think carefully about the content that we are offering and being sure that it's something that our audience, our consumers are going to say, yes, I'm willing to pay for that.
In terms of general quality, how would you assess what the news media are doing today? Is the journalism still pretty good, or has it declined along with some of the other things we've been talking about?
Well, there's a mix. Clearly, there are some fabulous stories and reports that are out every single day across a wide range of media. And, you know, I assume we'll talk a little bit more about some of the newer players, some of these nonprofits that are popping into the realm as well. In general, one of the things that happened with newspapers is as resources and staff were cut, a lot of that beat reporting, the beat staff got cut, which means you didn't have a reporter following education or following health or science or the environment on a regular basis, which then leads to the risk of missing those stories that are slower to evolve, that are that take sort of a deeper connection to what's happening and the people that are involved in a particular industry to really be able to see what's going on before something pops. To not just follow that big story from one to the next. At the same time, we see a real diminishment in the bureaus and staff that local papers have out in Washington, D.C., following their local congressmen. Several years ago, we hit the mark where you had less than half the states that had a reporter out in the D.C. area reporting back to their constituents back home what that congressperson was doing. And we've had senators and representatives tell us it makes a difference. You know, when you're giving your press conference and you see that reporter in front of you day in and day out recording what you're saying, it makes you stop and think a little bit more than if there's nobody out there sitting right in front of you that you know is going to be reporting back. We've seen signs on the television side as well. We did a special content study for this report that looked at cable television from 2007 up to 2012. And what we saw there was a real shift in the kind of stories that are coming on the air, and particularly if you look at primetime, a movement away from those packaged stories, the produced, edited, packaged pieces, which were particularly popular on CNN, to much more of an interview style, which tends to require fewer resources. It's something you have more control over in terms of the person bringing in, but generally tends to require fewer resources. Local television, from the snapshot study that we've done, seems to be putting more and more of their airtime into sports, weather, and traffic as well, rather than government or other local issues that may be at hand.
I think you said 40% of the newscast is devoted to things such as this rather than actual news.
In what we studied, yes, absolutely.
The irony there is, and this is pointed out also in your report, is the fact that the things that they are providing the public are things that the public can get just as easily on their cell phone now and have even less reason, perhaps, in the future to tune in this local newscast.
Well, that's one of the points that we write about in the report, is that when we look at the various industries, local television was really one that emerged over this past year to seem newly vulnerable to us. And it's not just in the content they're producing, but absolutely, as you say, these sorts of topics, weather, traffic, sports, are things that any number of outlets could provide if you think about your mobile phone and the apps that you might have that perhaps is more convenient for the consumer as they're, you know, out and about over the course of the day to turn to that for that information for. And, you know, local television is still still the number one source when you ask people where they turned for news yesterday. You know, do you turn to local television, to cable, to newspapers, to the Internet? Local television is still first, but it's dropped considerably, and particularly among young people. And over this past year, when we looked at the audiences for local television across all the four network affiliate stations and the four sweeps months, there were declines for every sweeps month for all four of the network affiliates. So not a strong year when it comes to audience. Their economy, the economics are relying more than ever on the election ad money that's come in, and this was quite a boon year for them in terms of that election advertising. There was more money than ever. But if you took that away, many of the other categories, pretty much all of them except the auto industry, those categories all fell for the year. So it leaves them much more reliant and vulnerable to that odd even year, sort of, you know, you don't have an election every year, to the even year ad spending to keep them afloat in those other years.
Well, the people who run the local stations must be very concerned with the fact that the younger audience is dropping, because it's going to be very, very difficult, I would think, to win that audience back. And that is the future for these organizations.
Absolutely. So one of the questions is, you know, what will their transition to digital be? And they had been slower than other industries in many cases to move to the web. Now, certainly there are television stations that are exceptions to this. So it's still not entirely clear, you know, what their opportunity is in the digital realm in terms of capturing that audience and that young audience in particular.
I wonder if they'll ever get the young audience back. I mean, this digital world is moving so quickly. And as you indicated earlier, so many mobile opportunities to collect your information, view your information, that the traditional sources would really seem to be potential big losers.
Yeah, I mean, you certainly, you know, it's certainly doesn't look promising when you look at the numbers and where young people are going and the degree to which they're not, you know, following local television at all. You know, many choosing to not even purchase telephones and have, you know, when they want to know about news, they're jumping first to something that's in the digital space to watch and to view and to listen. So there are real questions ahead.
You know, it was interesting. I spoke to a group at Washington University recently, a group of students, and I asked them where they got their news. I said, particularly, do you read the newspapers? And no hands went up. And I said, well, do you feel well-informed? And they all said yes, because the first thing they do in the morning is reach for their phone and read the Washington Post or the New York Times or whatever. They're getting it. They're just getting it a lot differently than you and I did at that age.
Yes, absolutely. One of the ways that, you know, one of the things we've seen is it is important sort of to think about the way you phrase that question to young people, because newspapers often mean something different than when you ask them about what is a digital paper.
Yeah.
And they're thinking about the places that they go online. And we do see in some of the research that we've done in other areas that the the bulk of information and the bulk of original reporting is still at this point coming from newspapers in particular in this realm, and they still tend to have a very large audience and a lot of people getting their information. But there are more and more that are entering into that realm as well.
That's Amy Mitchell, the acting director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism at the Pew Research Center. She oversaw the recent report on the state of the media for this most recent year. That's what we're talking about. We'll come back and continue that conversation in just a moment. Conversation with Amy Mitchell. We'll take a one-minute break and be right back. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our conversation with Amy Mitchell. We are talking about the state of media today. This is a follow-up to a report which she oversaw, put out by the Pew Research Center, the state of the media for the most recent year. Amy, is there a trust component at all in all of this with regard to news consumers seeing what's happening to the media and the way it's changing? Are they trusting news sources less, or is it pretty much the same?
Well, absolutely trust and sort of that credibility you have with your audience has been, an important element for news organizations, you know, for decades and decades. Trust in general, when you ask that question, it's gone down year after year after year, not only for the news industry, but for others, other industries as well. But one of the things we do see is, with the mobile, with tablet, and with smartphones, in many ways sort of a coming back to brand. If we think back, if we think about the early digital days and the desktop, which was very much driven by search, people saying, I want to get this one piece of information really quickly, typing it in your search, grabbing that piece of information, in many cases not really even paying attention to where it was coming from, and more not even clicking on that story itself, but just grabbing the three lines of information that, that pop up in that search and then moving on quickly to the next activity or next thing that you're going to be doing digitally. In the tablet realm and in the smartphone realm as well, what we're seeing is not only a sort of a movement towards longer form reading, personal interest meeting, but in many cases a coming back to brand. When we ask people in an early tablet survey, sort of what led you to download a news app? What were the reasons for that? One of the most prominent ones was the fact that it came from a news organization that you liked. So making a choice to now the other one was that it was very low cost or it was free, which doesn't help the industry a lot. But that it was coming from an organization that you liked. And another thing that we're seeing is, as people are getting news across many different platforms over the course of even a single day, they tend often to go to those same brands across all their digital realms and even their legacy realms, if it exists in that. So going to the St. Louis Post or the St. Louis Beacon or NPR, both on your tablet, on your phone, on your desktop, sort of having those apps and that information available to you across all the devices that you use for news.
Now, you mentioned the St. Louis Beacon, which is really quite a remarkable product, I think. How much of that sort of thing is going on across the country?
Well, it's really moving to be a permanent part of news. They're still very small in number when you look at the entire news industry across the country, but they are growing, and there are many that have now hit a point where they're they've established themselves not as a replacement for other local news like the local newspaper, but as one that can help fill in the gaps for some of the deeper reporting, some of the beat reporting, some of that reporting that takes longer to develop, that newsrooms. Traditional newsrooms may no longer have the capacity to do, at least not at this point. We just saw a nonprofit entity that was a staff of three, I believe, it was three or four, win a Pulitzer inside Climate for work that they did on a oil spill out in the state of Michigan. So there can be some tremendous reporting that's coming out of these organizations. One of the things we do see, though, is that there is a vulnerability in terms of their financial state, sort of that kind of living hand to mouth in terms of figuring out how you are going to bring in the revenue that you need.
Not unlike public radio, I might suggest.
Right,
you have to
right.
You have to rely on your consumers for that.
Absolutely, and one of the things we've also seen in the last year is that for some of these operations, and there are others too, places like Inside Science that do this at a more national level, or ProPublica, where traditional news outlets are seeing the value, and instead of viewing them really as competitors, they're seeing in a way, here we are, we can have partnerships. And we started to see this a few years back with bloggers that were developing at the very, very local level, where they can provide this kind of information. And what your audience is looking for is to find that story, to find that piece of news, to find something interesting to read. And if you're carrying a story bylined by ProPublica or by the St. Louis Beacon inside your news realm, that's okay, that's a service to citizens. You're in a way putting sort of your stamp of approval on that.
Yeah, there are a couple of points here I'd like to get you to respond to. They're all related, so I'll lump them together if you don't mind. Going back to your report, I'm quoting here, news organizations are less equipped to question what is coming to them or to uncover the stories themselves, and interest groups, you alluded to that earlier, are better equipped and have more technological tools than ever. The number of journalists in the country is down. The number of publicists is up, which is a little bit scary to some of us. And then there's the question of unfiltered information, that being that newsmakers can go directly to the public now and bypass editorial scrutiny. And you mentioned that the politicians really kind of like having the reporters watch them. But this is even better because they can say what they want and nobody's there to challenge it.
Yeah, this is sort of the flip side of some of what's emerging in nonprofit and others that are, you know, really looking to kind of help fill that gap in the traditional news industry. That technology doesn't just enable news organizations, it enables a whole lot of others in terms of putting information out, and they have, you know, certainly rights to access to consumers and to citizens. And but this is happening at a time when the news media, the traditional media in particular, that really has provided the bulk of the kind of watchdog role over this country, is working under very diminished resources, and in many cases doesn't have the capacity that they used to have to question things as they come into their newsroom. You know, we've had examples where you've had you know, the Malaysian government that was able to sort of bankroll press releases that went to very top news organizations that ended up running before it was realized that they were paid for reports from the government, from the Malaysian government. You've got press relation folks at some of these companies that, you know, tell me anecdotally, I have news reporters calling me to say, what's going on? What's the story here? And then I see my words nearly verbatim inside those news stories the next day. So it's a question of capacity and being able to, for the news industry to be able to serve that role of questioning information that's coming at them as well as coming at consumers directly. In the political realm, we saw very, very strongly in this last election the ability of the campaigns to bypass the media to a large degree, go directly to their constituents, to potential voters through their social media realms in particular, putting out information, having many, many updates and blog posts over the course of a day to keep people engaged. At the same time, the media itself and the reporting that it did was following the lead of the campaigns, to put it simply, much more so than they had done in the past. When we look at the assertions, the comments about the characters and the backgrounds of the candidates, to a much larger degree this election than we've seen any of the last four presidential elections, which we have tracked in the same way, we are seeing those assertions coming directly from partisans, people that are involved in the campaign or are somehow aligned to the campaign, as opposed to coming from the journalists themselves.
For those of you in the audience just joining us, you're listening to Amy Mitchell, Acting Director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism at the Pew Research Center. We're talking about the state of the media today, and Amy has overseen a project by Pew which did a complete survey and report of what is going on, and that is what we were talking about. You know, with what you just said, Amy, it seems to me that there's more pressure than ever on the consumers of news to really hone those critical thinking skills. Well, we'll call that media literacy, because you really have to figure out who is coming at you.
Absolutely. It's a wealth of opportunity. You can get access to more kinds of information. You think about the global access that we have to outlets that you never could have reached before. But there's also a whole lot more work. There's a lot more to filter through. There's a lot more to make sense of. There are a lot of questions to ask. If you're searching for information, you come across a website. You know, we've found that it can often take three or four clicks into that website to figure out actually who's producing that information and who's paying for it to be produced.
So there again, the pressure is on, and it really would do all of us well to really take advantage of those skills and what access we have to these various devices. No question about it.
And, you know, one of the things that we didn't really touch on was the role that the citizen is playing themselves in this day and age in terms of providing information and being a part of that news production process to a certain degree. And that's something that's evolved quite interestingly over the last several years, where, you know, early on there was sort of this this feeling of there's going to be the citizen reporter of, you know, I'm going to be a local blogger, I'm going to do my own reporting, I'm going to, in a way, replace what the news organizations are doing. And what happened along the way was the realization that, gosh, it's actually pretty hard to do this, to go out, to be there when an event is happening, to do a full report, to go ask questions, to talk to a lot of sources. But then over time, particularly with social media, there's been a sort of a new kind of valued role for the citizen, and that is being able to, on the one hand, be able to announce events, to pass along very important news as it happens if you are an eyewitness, but the other is to add insights, to add perspective, to share, to pass along things that you see as important pieces of information or valuable things to learn about to others, but to really be a more engaged part of that process from start to finish.
I'm glad you took it in this direction, because that's exactly where I wanted to go. We're all familiar, obviously, with what went on during the Arab Spring and how we were getting information from that part of the world through the social media. But on the Diane Rehm show earlier today, there was an interesting discussion with regard to the so-called democratization of media, particularly with regard to what's been happening this week in Boston, and the fact that there was so much misinformation that was presented as fact. CNN was one of the biggest culprits here in presenting the fact that there had been an arrest in this bombing case, when that, in fact, hadn't happened. And what is taking place with all of these people, with all of their devices, having certain input? There's a pressure to be first on the part of the major media, and a lot of people out there are taking hearsay as fact, putting it out there, and all of a sudden it's on the network.
Yeah, you know, in this particular case, I'm not so sure that the social media was as much involved in CNN and you know, the AP and others that put out this information that I believe at the time was coming from one unnamed source.
Right.
That was decisions that were made within those news organizations, and speaks to the the balance or lack thereof of wanting to be first and put information out and following a story versus saying, you know, have we done our full reporting on this? How many sources should we be having, and do we have those? And do we have somebody that will go on the record for that, let alone what it may mean for the investigation, as the FBI has alluded to this morning as well. So I'm not sure that was as much tied to the influence of social media, but clearly speaks to the need in this day and age, where there's always new information coming out. There's this constant sort of pressure to say something new, to step back and say, you know, it's got to be right first, and it's got to be complete. One of the things we've talked about is this movement towards more of an incremental kind of reporting, where you get, you know, piecemeal, so sort of piece of information after another, and it's up to the citizen to kind of put all those pieces together and make sense of it. Well, that's a job for news organizations to do, and that's one of the roles that they can really take on in this day and age, where there is so much that's coming out minute by minute, to be able to go to a place at the end of the day and say, I want to sit down and get one solid sense of what's happened. I don't want to have to read 45 tweets or, you know, look and figure out which one is right now that wasn't right before. But to have an organization that's going to help you make sense of the day's events.
There's an irony here as well, and that is that the various devices that almost everyone carries these days may very likely help solve this particular crime, because they're already talking about photographs that have been taken that might possibly indicate who placed those bombs.
Yeah, you know, it's like all of this. So much of what's happened with technology is there's pros and there's cons, there's pluses and there's minuses, and you know, the job we all have is to figure out how you have those pluses, you know, be at the greater end than the minuses, and figuring out how you use these things responsibly, both as consumers and as producers and sharers of news, to be sure if you're going to pass along a piece of information to your friends, to your family members, to the folks that are, you know, following you on Twitter, that you're pretty sure that it's right. Or that you have a reason that you're putting that out and that you can stand by that information. It, you know, as consumers are brought into this, that they take on a responsibility as well for the information that they're sharing and that they're passing along.
We're going to move on to discuss marketing today in the today's digital age in just a moment. But, Amy, before we take a break and continue that part of the conversation, is there anything you'd like to add with regard to what the report found that we haven't discussed?
Well, you know, certainly economics are a big part of it, and I figure we can get into some of that in the next half hour.
Okay, we will do that. That is Amy Mitchell, Acting Director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism at the Pew Research Center. Joining us in just a moment will be Jim Stewart, partner in the DICOM marketing firm in St. Louis. We'll talk about the digital influence in marketing in today's new world. Back in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back. Joining Amy Mitchell of the Pew Research Center and me now is Jim Stewart, partner owner of DICOM Marketing Services in St. Louis. His clients include some of the more familiar names in the St. Louis marketplace. We're talking with him and Amy about marketing in the digital age. Jim, by the way, will be joining Amy and others at the Yumsilla Grand Center event later today. The Public Relations Society of America St. Louis chapter and American Marketing Association present discussion of the Pew State of the Media report from 4:30 to 6:30 this afternoon and evening here at the Yumsilla Grand Center. That's at 3651 Olive. Jim, nice to have you with us. Say hi to Amy Mitchell.
Hi, Amy. How are you?
Hey, Jim. Good.
We've been talking a lot, Jim, about the state of the news media today, and of course, one of the big factors is the economics of the journalism today. As a marketer, do you have any real good ideas for a business plan for our newspapers?
They're doing the best they can. I've got some stats from the Business Insider, and in the last 13 years, newspaper revenue has fallen from $64 billion to $20 billion. So they're trying to do other programs with online, but it's just not that easy. It's just so fiercely competitive, and media consumption habits have changed.
What is the biggest change in marketing these days as a result of our digital explosion?
Well, there's by far the biggest. I've been doing this 30 years, and by far the single biggest change is from the advent of the personal computer, believe it or not. We used to do everything by hand, all of the calculation, all of the math, everything. And all of a sudden, with the personal computer, you could now use software and programs and have access to information like never before. And then the next step is the PC networking ability, and then finally all of the research. So. Mm-hmm. With respect to digital, it's just a whole other platform. Digital is the equivalent of cable television 25, 30 years ago when it rolled on with 100 stations. All of a sudden, digital comes online and there's hundreds of thousands, if not millions.
And I suppose you could categorize some of the social media platforms as platforms when we talk about Facebook and YouTube and Twitter.
Right. And that's a whole other variable. I mean, you know, digital is made up of all of these pieces. You've got what's called SEM, which is search engine marketing, where people type in keywords and phrases. And then you've got the entire platform of banners. Then you've got the entire platform of social. So it's trying to understand and get all of those platforms to work together. And what's nice is it's more measurable than ever before. And that's been
measurable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We can literally track links from people clicking on ads. And so that's, you know, 30 years ago, that really wasn't an option. And now all of a sudden, we can start to get measurability on a daily basis and find out how we're doing.
Yeah. Amy, with regard to the business plan for newspapers, are you hearing anything about how that might go, what direction that might take beyond the paywall?
There are actually a lot of experiments that are happening, and we've done a couple of reports on these. They're, few and far between at this point, but in many cases, they're actually revenues that are not tied necessarily to the news product. So if you think, for example, you know, there's a paper that completely reinvented its ad sales force. To put them in tiers and clusters and approach that whole advertising in a different way. There's another, several actually at this point, that have developed inside their news organization's main building a web analytics team web consulting team, where they will help local businesses design their websites and their social media component and advise them and consult with them on the kinds of things that they would want to have on their website, the ways to reach their local community members. And they're bringing in, you know, real experts in this area. So it's not that they're, you know, pulling people that used to work in a different area inside that news organization to do this. They're really developing it and seeing some financial success. You know, the Deseret News is an example that has moved very much in the digital direction, but also at the same time completely rethought its print edition and actually creates a pretty different product in print form than it does in digital form, because it feels that audience is different and now creates this print product for a very national audience targeted around certain kinds of information that they really focus on. So there are experiments, there are things that are happening. It's helping to close that gap. So we had the digital paywalls help bring in, you know, sort of beef up that circulation revenue number that was declining as people were giving up their print subscriptions. The advertising revenue is the one that continues to really fall and fall and fall and fall, because, you know, it's dollars in print to dimes in digital, to pennies in mobile for the most part here for these organizations. But then to develop this third tier that may be able to serve as sort of the filling that bridge between the advertising and the circulation.
Jim, this whole notion of tracking behavior, I guess we could call it the Google model. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah, it's interesting. We can getting back to the measurability, not only that, on how we deliver the message, we can deliver based on geographic variables. We can literally do a 5-mile radius around a location, a specific site, if you only have one location in a given town. But we can also look at how people consume media. What articles are they reading? If you're reading an article on retirement, I can serve up my bank's retirement ad. And I use the frame or the term stalker software, but these banner ads can actually literally follow you for 4 or 5 days. And we can actually tell the ads how long to follow you. And after 3 or 4 days, if you don't click on it, then we can stop that program.
You may use the term stalker in-house, but that's the very thing that I think bothers a lot of people. You wouldn't use it publicly. A lot of people are afraid of this kind of technology.
Yeah, I use it as a tongue-in-cheek phrase.
Sure.
The key variable, and it's actually it's been this way in advertising forever, is at a certain point you reach burnout. And that's when agencies know when to rotate in new creative. And it's the same way as we can literally turn off this ad, this banner ad that's been following you for 3 or 4 days. And hopefully that's going to take something out. But getting back to what was mentioned earlier on the newspapers with the platform of the digital product, it's the exact same way with TV and radio, and that's what they're competing against really back in the early 90s, mid-90s. For the first time, all of these media saw what they had never had before, which was a new revenue stream. And so all of a sudden, they realized, gosh, not only can we sell airtime over the air, but there's another revenue stream. And so the newspaper's challenge is they now have to compete against the TV stations that have this revenue stream and the radio stations and all the magazines that have the same product line.
Well, when you talk about television stations, we'd have to bring in terms of advertising, we'd also have to bring in the DVR, where people can not only bypass the commercials, you know, they'll watch maybe a couple of days after the big sale, that sort of thing. How do you deal with that?
That's always a challenge. It depends on what your objective is. If you're pushing a brand, that's okay. You know, if you're pushing a very specific opportunity, a specific sale that ends at a certain date, that's more of a challenge. So it really depends on what you're trying to accomplish with the program.
Yeah. Amy, what are your thoughts on all of this? I'm particularly interested in what your thoughts might be on the behavior tracking aspect.
Well, you know, there's absolutely a question of what the public is, you know, how far they're willing to go down that road in terms of feeling like it's helpful. You know, if I'm looking for information on a trip I'm going to take to Hawaii, is it helpful to have these ads pop up, or do I suddenly feel, wait a minute, who's really watching me, and do I really want them to watch all that I'm doing? So there really is a tricky balance there, and the public isn't entirely, you know, always entirely clear on where they come down on that either. But this ability to really know the audience and to know consumers' behavior across the whole range of things that they're doing in the digital realm is actually what one of the things that has hurt the news industry the most, because they don't know that. The folks that know that are Google and Facebook and Apple, and that has given those big tech companies more and more control over the development in this digital digital arena. And news organizations are just trying to keep up, and really having a difficult time being able to compete with that level of knowledge. If you're looking to advertise, and you've got, we're seeing this now happen with local digital ad buys, where Google and Facebook have suddenly put a lot of resources into developing ways that they can, you know, very, very, very minutely target and specify local digital ads. So your local, you know, cleaner shop, your local car dealer may very well be choosing at this point to buy those ads through Google or through another big national ad network, as opposed to going through a local provider, because it's more efficient and it gets them to a better targeted level. So this is something that has really left news organizations in a place of vulnerability. If we look in the mobile realm, which grew 80% in advertising in 2012. Facebook didn't even operate in the mobile realm until this past summer, but mobile already accounts for about a quarter of all of its ad revenue. So once they decide to do something, they can do it very, very quickly and powerfully. 72% of mobile display advertising revenue, which is where news really operates, now goes to six companies, none of which are producers of news.
And this mobile area, Jim, is something that you're obviously very cognizant of and always, I'm sure, looking for ways to utilize it.
Yeah, it's real interesting. This is probably the most unique specific category right now is the mobile. Last year, for the first time ever, smartphones overtook PC sales, which has never happened before. Mm-hmm. But the challenge is people view their smartphone differently than they do a television or radio station. Because it mostly has their personal consumption habits on there and their personal data, their photographs of their family, where they've been going. And so they actually view the smartphone really as more a part of an extension of their personality. So there's a lot less patience when they're served up ads on their smartphone. It's almost kind of like an invasion. So it's very tricky trying to balance where you're alienating somebody by having an ad pop up. The only caveat is most of the time when people download these apps, they have an option. They can buy it for $1 or $2 or $3, or they can get it for free. And they know if they get it for free, then the price of the freedom is going to be an ad popping up every now and then.
Do they know that?
Yeah, they're not completely foolish. And I myself have downloaded apps where I've gotten them for free, and then sure enough, when the ads start hitting, I go, okay, fine, I'm going to go ahead and buy this app and not have to worry about that situation.
Amy, most of us know that there's no such thing as that free lunch.
Absolutely. Well, that's what the news industry realized after they started giving all their information out for free for so long. Was wait a minute, this isn't supposed to be free. We got to get something for this. And now they're trying to catch up and get back to an even line.
Jim, who is your most important demographic group? Now, I know it would change with various products and what have you, but you know, and basically in broadcasting, it's 18 to 34, for instance.
Yeah, you know, to your point, it's exactly what you said. It depends on the product line. I can tell you that the baby boomers is just a huge, huge physical presence.
And 77 million baby boomers.
Yeah, and so that's a group. Not only that, they've established growth and wealth over time. So certainly that category can't be overlooked. But then you've got all of the 18 to 49 and 25 to 54-year-olds that you just can't overlook because they're the up-and-comers. So it really goes to the product.
Yeah, but a lot of those up-and-comers are still at home or staying at home. Here's my point. 77 million baby boomers, they have most of the disposable income. They buy the luxury products. They take the trips. The kids are out of college and the house is paid for. And yet it would seem to me the advertising world kind of pushes them aside for this group that is still living at home.
They do, but there's a lot of nuances in that. A good example is the older that you get, you typically consume more media. You have more time. So I can actually target an 18 to 49 group and be very comfortable that I'm going to reach the 35 to 54 or 35 to 64-year-old to even a higher degree because they may consume that media to a much higher degree than the younger folks. Mm-hmm. The trick is actually trying to reach the younger folks because they're just not the same as we were 30 years ago.
Well, here we go again, Amy. It takes us back to some of the things that we were talking about earlier.
Yeah, you know, we've certainly seen when we look in the tablet and in the smartphone realm, we ask people about paying for news, about either a digital subscription or a digital having actually paid for a news app. That is much more common among not only the older population, but the more educated, more highly educated, those with higher income levels, those that sort of fit in within that tier. And young people are more active in many cases in this realm, but, you know, began consuming news and consuming content in many ways in an era where a whole heck of a lot of it was free. And so they start with the premise of why would I pay for this, as opposed to sort of the assumption that you're going to pay if you want to get something like this.
And, Jim, going back to the baby boomers, a lot of these folks, God bless them, aren't really very sophisticated when it comes to this new technology and in many cases fear it.
I'm one of those. What is the funnest part of that is you have your influencers around you to force you to adapt. Years ago, getting on Facebook, I've got my kids constantly saying, "Look, you need to do this, you need to do that," and I'm like, "Fine, just walk me through it." So
that's the positive to having the kids come back home after college. They can help you out with Facebook, right?
Yeah, and remember, be nice to your kids. They're going to take care of you when you're older. Right. You know, that doesn't go away.
One other area I want to get to with you, and Amy, chime in anytime you've got something to add here. It concerns the use of email and email blasts, and I'll personalize it to this extent. Within the last couple of weeks, I have started to get what these bulk email things.
Right.
I get 50 of them a day. They're an awful, awful nuisance.
Yeah.
Somebody's making big use of this stuff.
Yeah, there's a couple of really important issues going on in our industry. I can tell you, with regard to television and radio, you have Arbitron and Nielsen, and they're very, very good quality research companies, and they have established the reputation for gathering data. There was an article that came out a few weeks ago in Ad Age that said, look, a lot of the digital providers don't have that neutral third-party measurement. And so one issue is making sure that the data that you and advertisers are receiving, that you've delivered 50,000 emails, really happened. You know, you need that third-party measurement because it may be only 20,000. But on the whole email blast side, there's some issues. Number one, you can once they come in, you're allowed to block them out. So the software allows you to say, this is junk email. I don't want to hear from these folks anymore. On the legislative side, they have to give you an opt-out. And many times, you may not know this, but you've opted in to receive the email when you've signed up for a newsletter or joined a website. So you may have opted in and not even necessarily known it.
And the problem is it takes time to unsubscribe 50 times, twice a day.
Every day, yeah.
Amy, do you buy into the sophistication of Nielsen and Arbitron?
Well, I mean, absolutely. And they're also finding their way, too, into how do you measure in this digital realm. And one of the things that's been a challenge for both the analysts as well as those inside the industry is how do you track audience in this digital space? How do you know if you have the same person coming to you across a number of different outlets? All of those metrics are really still developing in many ways and can provide very different numbers, but they are, that's what their focus is on, and then they're working hard at this. And, you know, one of the questions that it comes to the consumer is when they start to feel violated, whether it's because they're having to go in and unsubscribe, to have those boxes checked in as opposed to unchecked whenever you go to sign up for anything, can really seem like make somebody feel like they're being taken advantage of in a way that you know, may turn them off. And that's part of what, you know, one of the biggest focuses we talk about, whether you're a news organization or a company trying to reach out to people or a political candidate, is understanding your audience, understanding the way that they're getting information, understanding the things that they're interested in, the way that they operate, and taking your cue from that.
Yeah. We just have a few seconds left. Do you want to put a cap on your side of this, Jim?
Yeah, it's dynamic. It's changing. Companies are adapting and learning, but it's more challenging and fun than it's ever been. It's measurable.
Amy, in just a few seconds, are we at the stage where we're building the Mercury capsule, or are we on the launching pad?
Oh, I think we're a bit off the launching pad, but there's still a whole lot to develop and a lot to figure out in this realm, and a lot that we can't even imagine at this point.
I want to thank you so much, Amy, for being with us today. Amy's the acting director for the Project for Excellence in Journalism at the Pew Research Center. Jim Stewart, also with us, a partner in the DICOM marketing firm. The two of them will be here at Umsulit Grand Center from 4:30 to 6:30 this afternoon as guests of the Public Relations Society of America and the St. Louis chapter of American Marketing Association. They'll be discussing that Pew Media Research Report. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Enjoyed having this conversation. Join Steve Potter tomorrow for Cityscape, when members of the music ensemble, the 442s, will talk about how the group came together and play some samples of their music. Also, Aaron Williams talks with writer and producer Tony Nitko about his new film that seeks to engage and educate hearing people about deaf life and survival. Monday on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about current issues pertaining to the law with a panel of legal experts. Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis On the Air is produced by Mary Edwards and Alex Hoyer, with production assistance from Aaron Dorr, Spencer Reed, and Drew Becker. Executive producer, Robert Peterson. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.